forging alliances. It was composed of his own Al-Qaeda Shura, together with leaders or representatives of terrorist organizations that were still independent. In building this Islamic army, he enlisted groups from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Oman, Algeria, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Somalia, and Eritrea. Al-Qaeda also established cooperative but less formal relations with other extremist groups from these same countries. From the African states of Chad, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Uganda, and from the Southeast Asian states of Burma, Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Bin Laden maintained connections in the Bosnian conflict as well. The groundwork for a true global terrorist network was being laid. Bin Laden also provided equipment and training assistance to the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in the Philippines, and also to a newly forming Philippine group that called itself the Abu Sayyaf Brigade, after one of the major Afghan jihadist commanders. Al-Qaeda helped Jamaah Islamiyah, a nascent organization headed by Indonesian Islamists with cells scattered across Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, and the Philippines. It also aided a Pakistani group engaged in insurrectionist attacks in Kashmir. In mid-1991, Bin Laden dispatched a band of supporters to the northern Afghanistan border to assist the Tajikistan Islamists in the ethnic conflicts that had been boiling there even before the Central Asian departments of the Soviet Union became independent states. This pattern of expansion through building alliances extended to the United States. A Muslim organization called Al-Qipa had numerous branch offices, the largest of which was in the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn. In the mid-1980s, it had been set up as one of the first outposts of Azam and Bin Laden's Maq. Other cities with branches of Al-Qipa included Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Tucson. Al-Qipa recruited American Muslims to fight in Afghanistan. Some of them would participate in terrorist actions in the United States in the early 1990s, and in Al-Qaeda operations elsewhere, including the 1998 attacks on U.S. embassies in East Africa. Section 2.4. Building on Organization, Declaring War on the U.S. Bin Laden began delivering diatribes against the United States before he left Saudi Arabia. He continued to do so after he arrived in Sudan. In early 1992, the Al-Qaeda leadership issued a fatwa calling for jihad against the Western occupation of Islamic lands. Specifically singling out U.S. forces for attack, the language resembled that which would appear in Bin Laden's public fatwa in August 1996. In ensuing weeks, Bin Laden delivered an often repeated lecture on the need to cut off the head of the snake. By this time, Bin Laden was well known and a senior figure among Islamist extremists, especially those in Egypt, the Arabian Peninsula, and the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region. Still, he was just one among many diverse terrorist barons. Some of Bin Laden's close comrades were more peers than subordinates. For example, Usama Azmuray, also known as Wali Khan, worked with Bin Laden in the early 1980s and helped him in the Philippines and in Tajikistan. The Egyptian spiritual guide based in New Jersey, the blind sheikh whom Bin Laden admired, was also in the network. Among sympathetic peers in Afghanistan were a few of the warlords, still fighting for power, and Abu Zubaydah, who helped operate a popular terrorist training camp near the border with Pakistan. There were also rootless but experienced operatives, such as Ramzi Youssef and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, though not necessarily formal members of someone else's organization, were traveling around the world and joining in projects that were supported by, or linked to, Bin Laden, the blind sheikh, or their associates. In now analyzing the terrorist programs carried out by members of this network, it would be misleading to apply the label al-Qaeda operations too often in these early years. It would also be misleading to ignore the significance of these connections. And in this network, bin Laden's agenda stood out. While his allied Islamist groups were focused on local battles, such as those in Egypt, Algeria, Bosnia, or Chechnya, bin Laden concentrated on attacking the far enemy, the United States. Attacks known and suspected. After U.S. troops deployed to Somalia in late 1992, al-Qaeda leaders formulated a fatwa demanding their eviction. In December, bombs exploded at two hotels in Aden, where U.S. troops routinely stopped en route to Somalia, killing two, but no Americans. The perpetrators are reported to have belonged to a group from southern Yemen, headed by a Yemeni member of bin Laden's Islamic Army, Shura. Some in the group had trained at an al-Qaeda camp in Sudan. Al-Qaeda leader set up a Nairobi cell and used it to send weapons and trainers to the Somali warlords battling U.S. forces, an operation directly supervised by al-Qaeda's military leader. Scores of trainers flowed to Somalia over the ensuing months, including most of the senior members and weapons training experts of al-Qaeda's military committee. These trainers were later heard boasting that their assistance led to the October 1993 shootdown of two U.S. Black Hawk helicopters by members of a Somali militia group, and to the subsequent withdrawal of U.S. forces in early 1994. In November 1995, a car bomb exploded outside a Saudi-U.S. joint facility in Riyadh for training the Saudi National Guard. Five Americans and two officials from India were killed. The Saudi government arrested four perpetrators who admitted being inspired by bin Laden. They were promptly executed. Though nothing proves that bin Laden ordered this attack, U.S. intelligence subsequently learned that al-Qaeda leaders had decided a year earlier to attack a U.S. target in Saudi Arabia and had shipped explosives to the peninsula for this purpose. Some of bin Laden's associates later took credit. In June 1996, an enormous truck bomb detonated in the Khobar Towers residential complex in Dhahran in Saudi Arabia that housed U.S. Air Force personnel. 19 Americans were killed, and 372 were wounded. The operation was carried out principally, perhaps exclusively, by Saudi Hezbollah, an organization that had received support from the government of Iran. While the evidence of Iranian involvement is strong, there are also signs that al-Qaeda played some role as yet unknown. In this period, other prominent attacks in which bin Laden's involvement is at best cloudy are the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, a plot that same year to destroy landmarks in New York, and the 1995 Manila air plot to blow up a dozen U.S. airliners over the Pacific. Details on these plots appear in Chapter 3. Another scheme revealed that bin Laden sought the capability to kill on a mass scale. His business aides received word that a Sudanese military officer, who had been a member of the previous government cabinet, was offering to sell weapons-grade uranium. After a number of contacts were made through intermediaries, the officer set the price at $1.5 million, which did not deter bin Laden. Al-Qaeda representatives asked to inspect the uranium and were shown a cylinder about 3 feet long, and one thought he could pronounce it genuine. Al-Qaeda apparently purchased the cylinder, then discovered it to be bogus. But while the effort failed, it shows what bin Laden and his associates hoped to do. One of the al-Qaeda representatives explained his mission. It's easy to kill more people with uranium. Bin Laden seemed willing to include in the Confederation terrorists from almost every corner of the Muslim world. His vision mirrored that of Sudan's Islamist leader, Turabi, who convened a series of meetings under the label Popular Arab and Islamic Conference around the time of bin Laden's arrival in that country. Delegations of violent Islamist extremists came from all the groups represented in bin Laden's Islamic Army, Shura. Representatives also came from organizations such as the Palestine Liberation Organization, Hamas, and Hezbollah. Turabi sought to persuade Shiites and Sunnis to put aside their divisions and join against the common enemy. In late 1991 or 1992, discussions in Sudan between al-Qaeda and Iranian operatives led to an informal agreement to cooperate in providing support, even if only training, for actions carried out primarily against Israel and the United States. Not long afterward, senior al-Qaeda operatives and trainers traveled to Iran to receive training in explosives. In the fall of 1993, another such delegation went to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon for further training in explosives as well as in intelligence and security. Bin Laden reportedly showed particular interest in learning how to use truck bombs, such as the one that had killed 241 U.S. Marines in Lebanon in 1983. The relationship between al-Qaeda and Iran demonstrated that Sunni-Shia divisions did not necessarily pose an insurmountable barrier to cooperation in terrorist operations. As will be described in Chapter 7, al-Qaeda contacts with Iran continued in ensuing years. Bin Laden was also willing to explore possibilities for cooperation with Iraq, even though Iraq's dictator, Saddam Hussein, had never had an Islamist agenda, save for his opportunistic pose as a defender of the faithful against crusaders during the Gulf War of 1991. Moreover, bin Laden had in fact been sponsoring anti-Saddam Islamists in Iraqi Kurdistan and sought to attract them into his Islamic army. To protect his own ties with Iraq, Turabi reportedly brokered an agreement that bin Laden would stop supporting activities against Saddam. Bin Laden apparently honored this pledge, at least for a time, although he continued to aid a group of Islamist extremists operating in part of Iraq, Kurdistan, outside of Baghdad's control. In the late 1990s, these extremist groups suffered major defeats by Kurdish forces. In 2001, with bin Laden's help, they reformed into an organization called Ansar al-Islam. There are indications that by then the Iraqi regime tolerated and may even have helped Ansar al-Islam against the common Kurdish enemy. With the Sudanese regime acting as intermediary, bin Laden himself met with a senior Iraqi intelligence officer in Khartoum in late 1994 or early 1995. Bin Laden is said to have asked for space to establish training camps as well as assistance in procuring weapons, but there is no evidence that Iraq responded to this request. As described below, the ensuing years saw additional efforts to establish connections. Sudan becomes a doubtful haven. Not until 1998 did al-Qaeda undertake a major terrorist operation of its own, in large part because bin Laden lost his base in Sudan. Ever since the Islamist regime came to power in Khartoum, the United States and other Western governments had pressed it to stop providing a haven for terrorist organizations. Other governments in the region, such as those of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and even Libya, which were targets of some of these groups, added their own pressure. At the same time, the Sudanese regime began to change. Though Turabi had been its inspirational leader, General Omar al-Bashir, president since 1989, had never been entirely under his thumb. Thus, as outside pressures mounted, Bashir's supporters began to displace those of Turabi. The attempted assassination in Ethiopia of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in June 1995 appears to have been a tipping point. The would-be killers, who came from the Egyptian Islamic group, had been sheltered in Sudan and helped by bin Laden. When the Sudanese refused to hand over three individuals identified as involved in the assassination plot, the UN Security Council passed a resolution criticizing their inaction and eventually sanctioned Khartoum in April 1996. A clear signal to bin Laden that his days in Sudan were numbered came when the government advised him that it intended to yield to Libya's demands to stop giving sanctuary to its enemies. Bin Laden had to tell the Libyans, who had been part of his Islamic army, that he could no longer protect them, and that they had to leave the country. Outraged, several Libyan members of al-Qaeda and the Islamic army Shura renounced all connections with him. Bin Laden also began to have serious money problems. International pressure on Sudan, together with strains in the world economy, hurt Sudan's currency. Some of Bin Laden's companies ran short of funds. As Sudanese authorities became less obliging, normal costs of doing business increased. Saudi pressures on the Bin Laden family also probably took some toll. In any case, Bin Laden found it necessary both to cut back his spending and to control his outlays more closely. He appointed a new financial manager whom his followers saw as miserly. Money problems proved costly to Bin Laden in other ways. Jamal Ahmed Al-Fadl, a Sudanese-born Arab, had spent time in the United States and had been recruited for the Afghan War through the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn. He had joined al-Qaeda and taken the oath of fealty to Bin Laden, serving as one of his business agents. Then Bin Laden discovered that Fadl had skimmed about $110,000, and he asked for restitution. Fadl resented receiving a salary of only $500 a month, while some of the Egyptians in al-Qaeda were given $1,200 a month. He defected and became a star informant for the United States. Also testifying about al-Qaeda in a U.S. court was Lusain Kurchtu, who told of breaking with Bin Laden because of Bin Laden's professed inability to provide him with money when his wife needed a cesarean section. In February 1996, Sudanese officials began approaching officials from the United States and other governments, asking what actions of theirs might ease foreign pressure. In secret meetings with Saudi officials, Sudan offered to expel Bin Laden to Saudi Arabia and asked the Saudis to pardon him. U.S. officials became aware of these secret discussions, certainly by March. Saudi officials apparently wanted Bin Laden expelled from Sudan. They had already revoked his citizenship, however, and would not tolerate his presence in their country. And Bin Laden may have no longer felt safe in Sudan, where he had already escaped at least one assassination attempt that he believed to have been the work of the Egyptian or Saudi regimes, or both. In any case, on May 19, 1996, Bin Laden left Sudan, significantly weakened despite his ambitions and organizational skills. He returned to Afghanistan. Section 2.5. Al-Qaeda's Renewal in Afghanistan. Bin Laden flew on a leased aircraft from Khartoum to Jalalabad, with a refueling stopover in the United Arab Emirates. He was accompanied by family members and guards, as well as by al-Qaeda members who had been close associates since his organization's 1988 founding in Afghanistan. Dozens of additional militants arrived on later flights. Though Bin Laden's destination was Afghanistan, Pakistan was the nation that held the key to his ability to use Afghanistan as a base from which to revive his ambitious enterprise for war against the United States. For the first quarter century of its existence as a nation, Pakistan's identity had derived from Islam, but its politics had been decidedly secular. The army was, and remains, the country's strongest and most respected institution, and the army had been, and continues to be, preoccupied with its rivalry with India, especially over the disputed territory of Kashmir. From the 1970s onward, religion had become an increasingly powerful force in Pakistani politics. After a coup in 1977, military leaders turned to Islamist groups for support, and fundamentalists became more prominent. South Asia had an indigenous form of Islamic fundamentalism which had developed in the 19th century at a school in the Indian village of Deoband. The influence of the Wahhabi school of Islam had also grown, nurtured by Saudi-funded institutions. Moreover, the fighting in Afghanistan made Pakistan home to an enormous and generally unwelcome population of Afghan refugees. and since the badly strained Pakistani education system could not accommodate the refugees, the government increasingly let privately funded religious schools serve as a cost-free alternative. Over time, these schools produced large numbers of half-educated young men with no marketable skills, but with deeply held Islamic views. Pakistan's rulers found these multitudes of ardent young Afghans a source of potential trouble at home, but potentially useful abroad. Those who joined the Taliban movement, espousing a ruthless version of Islamic law, perhaps could bring order in chaotic Afghanistan and make it a cooperative ally. They thus might give Pakistan greater security on one of the several borders where Pakistani military officers hoped for what they called strategic depth. It is unlikely that bin Laden could have returned to Afghanistan had Pakistan disapproved. The Pakistani Military Intelligence Service probably had advanced knowledge of his coming, and its officers may have facilitated his travel. During his entire time in Sudan, he had maintained guest houses and training camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan. These were part of a larger network used by diverse organizations for recruiting and training fighters for Islamic insurgencies in such places as Tajikistan, Kashmir, and Chechnya. Pakistani intelligence officers reportedly introduced bin Laden to Taliban leaders in Kandahar, their main base of power, to aid his reassertion of control over camps near Khoust, out of an apparent hope that he would now expand the camps and make them available for training Kashmiri militants. Yet bin Laden was in his weakest position since his early days in the war against the Soviet Union. The Sudanese government had canceled the registration of the main business enterprises he had set up there, and then put some of them up for public sale. According to a senior al-Qaeda detainee, the government of Sudan seized everything bin Laden had possessed there. He also lost the head of his military committee, Abu Ubaidah al-Banshiri, one of the most capable and popular leaders of al-Qaeda. While most of the group's key figures had accompanied bin Laden to Afghanistan, Banshiri had remained in Kenya to oversee the training and weapons shipments of the cell set up some 4 years earlier. He died in a ferry boat accident on Lake Victoria just a few days after bin Laden arrived in Jalalabad, leaving bin Laden with a need to replace him not only in the Shura, but also as supervisor of the cells and prospective operations in East Africa. He had to make other adjustments as well, for some al-Qaeda members viewed bin Laden's return to Afghanistan as an occasion to go off in their own directions. Some maintained collaborative relationships with al-Qaeda, but many disengaged entirely. For a time, it may not have been clear to bin Laden that the Taliban would be his best bet as an ally. When he arrived in Afghanistan, they controlled much of the country, but key centers, including Kabul, were still held by rival warlords. Bin Laden went, initially, to Jalalabad, probably because it was in an area controlled by a provincial council of Islamic leaders who were not major contenders for national power. He found lodgings with Yunis Khalis, the head of one of the main Mujahideen factions. Bin Laden apparently kept his options open, maintaining contacts with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who, though an Islamic extremist, was also one of the Taliban's most militant opponents. But after September 1996, when first Jalalabad and then Kabul fell to the Taliban, bin Laden cemented his ties with them. That process did not always go smoothly. Bin Laden, no longer constrained by the Sudanese, clearly thought that he had new freedom to publish his appeals for jihad. At about the time when the Taliban were making their final drive toward Jalalabad and Kabul, bin Laden issued his August 1996 fatwa, saying that, "We have been prevented from addressing the Muslims, but expressing relief that, by the grace of Allah, a safe base here is now available in the high Hindu Kush Mountains in Khorasan." But the Taliban, like the Sudanese, would eventually hear warnings, including from the Saudi monarchy. Though bin Laden had promised Taliban leaders that he would be circumspect, He broke this promise almost immediately, giving an inflammatory interview to CNN in March 1977. The Taliban leader, Mullah Omar, promptly invited bin Laden to move to Kandahar, ostensibly in the interests of bin Laden's own security, but more likely to situate him where he might be easier to control. There is also evidence that around this time, bin Laden sent out a number of feelers to the Iraqi regime, offering some cooperation. None are reported to have received a significant response. According to one report, Saddam Hussein's efforts at this time to rebuild relations with the Saudis and other Middle Eastern regimes led him to stay clear of bin Laden. In mid-1998, the situation reversed. It was Iraq that reportedly took the initiative. In March 1998, after bin Laden's public fatwa against the United States, two al-Qaeda members reportedly went to Iraq to meet with Iraqi intelligence. In July, an Iraqi delegation traveled to Afghanistan to meet first with the Taliban and then with bin Laden. Sources reported that one or perhaps both of these meetings was apparently arranged through bin Laden's Egyptian deputy, Zawahiri, who had ties of his own to the Iraqis. In 1998, Iraq was under intensifying U.S. pressure, which culminated in a series of large air attacks in December. Similar meetings between Iraqi officials and bin Laden or his aides may have occurred in 1999, during a period of some reported strains with the Taliban. According to the reporting, Iraqi officials offered bin Laden a safe haven in Iraq. Bin Laden declined, apparently judging that his circumstances in Afghanistan remain more favorable than the Iraqi alternative. The reports describe friendly contacts and indicate some common themes in both sides' hatred of the United States. But to date, we have seen no evidence that these or the earlier contacts ever developed into a collaborative operational relationship. Nor have we seen evidence indicating that Iraq cooperated with al-Qaeda in developing or carrying out any attacks against the United States. Bin Laden eventually enjoyed a strong financial position in Afghanistan, thanks to Saudi and other financiers associated with the Golden Chain. Through his relationship with Mullah Omar and the monetary and other benefits that it brought the Taliban, bin Laden was able to circumvent restrictions. Mullah Omar would stand by him even when other Taliban leaders raised objections. Bin Laden appeared to have, in Afghanistan, a freedom of movement that he had lacked in Sudan. Al-Qaeda members could travel freely within the country, enter and exit it without visas or any immigration procedures, purchase and import vehicles and weapons, and enjoy the use of official Afghan Ministry of Defense license plates. Al-Qaeda also used the Afghan state-owned Ariana Airlines to courier money into the country. The Taliban seemed to open the doors to all who wanted to come to Afghanistan to train in the camps. The alliance with the Taliban provided al-Qaeda a sanctuary in which to train and indoctrinate fighters and terrorists, import weapons, forge ties with other jihad groups and leaders, and plot and staff terrorist schemes. While bin Laden maintained his own al-Qaeda guest houses and camps for vetting and training recruits, he also provided support to and benefit from the broad infrastructure of such facilities in Afghanistan made available to the global network of Islamist movements. U.S. intelligence estimates put the total number of fighters who underwent instruction in bin Laden-supported camps in Afghanistan from 1996 through 9/11 at 10,000 to 20,000. In addition to training fighters and special operators, this larger network of guest houses and camps provided a mechanism by which al-Qaeda could screen and vet candidates for induction into its own organization. Thousands flowed through the camps, but no more than a few hundred seemed to have become al-Qaeda members. From the time of its founding, al-Qaeda had employed training and indoctrination to identify worthy candidates. Al-Qaeda continued, meanwhile, to collaborate closely with the many Middle Eastern groups, in Egypt, Algeria, Yemen, Lebanon, Morocco, Tunisia, Somalia, and elsewhere, with which it had been linked when bin Laden was in Sudan. It also reinforced its London base and its other offices around Europe, the Balkans, and the Caucasus. Bin Laden bolstered his links to extremists in South and Southeast Asia, including the Malaysian-Indonesian JI, and several Pakistani groups engaged in the Kashmir conflict. The February 1998 fatwa thus seems to have been a kind of public launch of a renewed and stronger al-Qaeda, after a year and a half of work. Having rebuilt his fundraising network, bin Laden had again become the rich man of the jihad movement. He had maintained or restored many of his links with terrorists elsewhere in the world, and he had strengthened the internal ties in his own organization. The inner core of al-Qaeda continued to be a hierarchical, top-down group with defined positions, tasks, and salaries. Most, but not all, in this core swore fealty, or bayat, to bin Laden. Other operatives were committed to bin Laden or to his goals, and would take assignments for him, but they did not swear bayat and maintained, or tried to maintain, some autonomy. A loose circle of adherents might give money to al-Qaeda or train in its camps, but remained essentially independent. Nevertheless, they constituted a potential resource for al-Qaeda. Now effectively merged with Zawahiri's Egyptian Islamic Jihad, al-Qaeda promised to become the general headquarters for international terrorism, without the need for the Islamic Army Shura. Bin Laden was prepared to pick up where he had left off in Sudan. He was ready to strike at the head of the snake. Al-Qaeda's role in organizing terrorist operations had also changed. Before the move to Afghanistan, it had concentrated on providing funds, training, and weapons for actions carried out by members of allied groups. The attacks on the U.S. embassies in East Africa in the summer of 1998 would take a different form. Planned, directed, and executed by al-Qaeda under the direct supervision of bin Laden and his chief aides. The embassy bombings. As early as December 1993, a team of al-Qaeda operatives had begun casing targets in Nairobi for future attacks. It was led by Ali Mohammed, a former Egyptian army officer who had moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, enlisted in the U.S. Army, and become an instructor at Fort Bragg. He had provided guidance and training to extremists at the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn, including some who were subsequently convicted in the February 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. The casing team also included a computer expert whose write-ups were reviewed by al-Qaeda leaders. The team set up a makeshift laboratory for developing their surveillance photographs in an apartment in Nairobi, where the various al-Qaeda operatives and leaders based in or traveling to the Kenya cell sometimes met. Banshiri, al-Qaeda's military committee chief, continued to be the operational commander of the cell. But because he was constantly on the move, bin Laden had dispatched another operative, Khaled al-Fawaz, to serve as the on-site manager. The technical surveillance and communications equipment employed for these casings missions included state-of-the-art video cameras obtained from China and from dealers in Germany. The casing team also reconnoitered targets in Djibouti. As early as January 1994, bin Laden received the surveillance reports, complete with diagrams prepared by the team's computer specialist. He, his top military committee members, Banshiri and his deputy, Abu Hafs al-Masri, also known as Mohammed Atef, and a number of other al-Qaeda leaders reviewed the reports. Agreeing that the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi was an easy target because a car bomb could be parked close by, they began to form a plan. Al-Qaeda had begun developing the tactical expertise for such attacks months earlier, when some of its operatives, top military committee members and several operatives who were involved with the Kenya cell among them, were sent to Hezbollah training camps in Lebanon. The cell in Kenya experienced a series of disruptions that may in part account for the relatively long delay before the attack was actually carried out. The difficulties bin Laden began to encounter in Sudan in 1995, his move to Afghanistan in 1996, and the months spent establishing ties with the Taliban may also have played a role, as did Banshiri's accidental drowning. In August 1997, the Kenya cell panicked. The London Daily Telegraph reported that Madani Al-Tayyib, formerly head of Al-Qaeda's finance committee, had turned himself over to the Saudi government. The article said, incorrectly, that the Saudis were sharing Tayyib's information with the U.S. and British authorities. At almost the same time, cell members learned that U.S. and Kenyan agents had searched the Kenya residence of Wadi al-Haga, who had become the new on-site manager to Nairobi, and that Haga's telephone was being tapped. Haga was a U.S. citizen who had worked with bin Laden in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and in 1992 he went to Sudan to become one of al-Qaeda's major financial operatives. When Haga returned to the United States to appear before a grand jury investigating bin Laden, the job of cell manager was taken over by Harun Fazul, a Kenyan citizen who had been in bin Laden's advance team to Sudan back in 1990. Harun faxed a report on the security situation to several sites, warning that the crew members in East Africa is in grave danger, in part because America knows that the followers of bin Laden carried out the operations to hit Americans in Somalia. The report provided instructions for avoiding further exposure. On February the 23rd, 1998, bin Laden issued his public fatwa. The language had been in negotiation for some time, as part of the merger underway between bin Laden's organization and Zawahiri's Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Less than a month after the publication of the fatwa, the teams that were to carry out the embassy attacks were being pulled together in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. The timing and content of their instructions indicate that the decision to launch the attacks had been made by the time the fatwa was issued. The next 4 months were spent setting up the teams in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. Members of the cells rented residences and purchased bomb-making materials and transport vehicles. At least one additional explosives expert was brought in to assist in putting the weapons together. In Nairobi, a hotel room was rented to put up some of the operatives. The suicide trucks were purchased shortly before the attack date. While this was taking place, bin Laden continued to push his public message. On May 7th, the deputy head of Al-Qaeda's military committee, Mohammed Atef, faxed to bin Laden's London office a new fatwa issued by a group of sheikhs located in Afghanistan. A week later, it appeared in Al-Quds Al-Arabi, the same Arabic-language newspaper in London that had first published bin Laden's February fatwa, and it conveyed the same message: the duty of Muslims to carry out holy war against the enemies of Islam and to expel the Americans from the Gulf region. 2 weeks after that, bin Laden gave a videotaped interview to ABC News with the same slogans, adding that, "We do not differentiate between those dressed in military uniforms and civilians. They are all targets in this fatwa." By August the 1st, members of the cells not directly involved in the attacks had mostly departed from East Africa. The remaining operatives prepared and assembled the bombs and acquired the delivery vehicles. On August the 4th, they made one last casing run at the embassy in Nairobi. By the evening of August the 6th, all but the delivery teams and one or two persons assigned to remove the evidence trail had left East Africa. Back in Afghanistan, bin Laden and the al-Qaeda leadership had left Kandahar for the countryside, expecting U.S. retaliation. Declarations taking credit for the attacks had already been faxed to the joint al-Qaeda-Egyptian-Islamic Jihad office in Baku, with instructions to stand by for orders to instantly transmit them to Al-Quds Al-Arabi. One proclaimed the formation of the Islamic Army for the Liberation of the Holy Places, and two others, one for each embassy, announced that the attack had been carried out by a company of a battalion of this Islamic Army. On the morning of August the 7th, the bomb-laden trucks drove into the embassies roughly 5 minutes apart. About 10:35 a.m. in Nairobi and 10:39 a.m. in Dar es Salaam. Shortly afterward, a phone call was placed from Baku to London. The previously prepared messages were then faxed to London. The attack on the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi destroyed the embassy and killed 12 Americans and 201 others, almost all Kenyans. About 5,000 people were injured. The attack on the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam killed 11 more people, none of them Americans. Interviewed later about the deaths of the Africans, bin Laden answered that, "When it becomes apparent that it would be impossible to repel these Americans without assaulting them, even if this involved the killing of Muslims, this is permissible under Islam." Asked if he had indeed masterminded these bombings, bin Laden said that the World Islamic Front for Jihad Against Jews and Crusaders had issued a crystal-clear fatwa. If the instigation for jihad against the Jews and the Americans to liberate the holy places is considered a crime, he said, let history be a witness that I am a criminal.
Chapter 3. Counterterrorism Evolves. In Chapter 2, we describe the growth of a new kind of terrorism and a new terrorist organization, especially from 1988 to 1998, when Osama bin Laden declared war and organized the bombing of two U.S. embassies. In this chapter, we trace the parallel evolution of government efforts to counter terrorism by Islamic extremists against the United States. We mention many personalities in this report. As in any study of the U.S. government, some of the most important characters are institutions. We will introduce various agencies and how they adapted to a new kind of terrorism. Section 3.1. From the Old Terrorism to the New, the First World Trade Center Bombing. At 18 minutes after noon on February 26, 1993, a huge bomb went off beneath the two towers of the World Trade Center. This was not a suicide attack. The terrorists parked a truck bomb with a timing device on level B2 of the underground garage, then departed. The ensuing explosion opened a hole 7 stories up. 6 people died. More than 1,000 were injured. An FBI agent at the scene described the relatively low number of fatalities as a miracle. President Bill Clinton ordered his National Security Council to coordinate the response. Government agencies swung into action to find the culprits. The counter-terrorist center located at the CIA combed its files and queried sources around the world. The National Security Agency, the huge Defense Department signals collection agency, ramped up its communications intercept network and searched its databases for clues. The New York field office of the FBI took control of the local investigation and in the end set a pattern for a future management of terrorist incidents. 4 features of this episode have significance for the story of 9/11. First, the bombing signaled a new terrorist challenge, one whose rage and malice had no limit. Ramzi Youssef, the Sunni extremist who planted the bomb, said later that he'd hoped to kill 250,000 people. Second, the FBI and the Justice Department did excellent work investigating the bombing. Within days, the FBI identified a truck remnant as part of a Ryder rental van reportedly stolen in Jersey City the day before the bombing. Mohamed Salameh, who had rented the truck and reported it stolen, kept calling the rental office to get back his $400 deposit. The FBI arrested him there on March 4, 1993. In short order, the Bureau had several plotters in custody, including Nidal Ayad, an engineer who'd acquired chemicals for the bomb, and Mahmoud Abu Halima, who had helped mix the chemicals. The FBI identified another conspirator, Ahmad Ajaj, who'd been arrested by immigration authorities at John F. Kennedy International Airport in September 1992 and charged with document fraud. His traveling companion was Ramzi Youssef, who had also entered with fraudulent documents but claimed political asylum and was admitted. It quickly became clear that Youssef had been a central player in the attack. He had fled to Pakistan immediately after the bombing and would remain at large for nearly 2 years. The arrests of Salameh, Abdul Halima, and Ayad led the FBI to the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn, where a central figure was Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, an extremist Sunni Muslim cleric who had moved to the United States from Egypt in 1990. In speeches and writings, the sightless Rahman, often called the Blind Sheikh, preached the message of Sayyid Qutb's milestones, characterizing the United States as the oppressor of Muslims worldwide, and asserting that it was their religious duty to fight against God's enemies. An FBI informant learned of a plan to bomb major New York landmarks, including the Holland and Lincoln tunnels. Disrupting this landmarks plot, the FBI, in June 1993, arrested Rahman and various Confederates. As a result of the investigations and arrests, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York prosecuted and convicted multiple individuals, including Ajaj, Salameh, Ayad, Abu Halima, the Blind Sheikh, and Ramzi Youssef, for crimes related to the World Trade Center bombing and other plots. An unfortunate consequence of this superb investigative and prosecutorial effort was that it created an impression that the law enforcement system was well equipped to cope with terrorism. Neither President Clinton, his principal advisors, the Congress, nor the news media felt prompted until later to press the question of whether the procedures that put the blind sheikh and Ramzi Youssef behind bars would really protect Americans against the new virus of which these individuals were just the first symptoms. Third, the successful use of the legal system to address the first World Trade Center bombing had the side effect of obscuring the need to examine the character and extent of the new threat facing the United States. The trials did not bring the Bin Laden network to the attention of the public and policymakers. The FBI assembled and the U.S. Attorney's Office put forward some evidence showing that the men in the dock were not the only plotters. Materials taken from Ajaj indicated that the plot or plots were hatched at or near the Khaldan camp, a terrorist training camp on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Ajaj had left Texas in April 1992 to go there to learn how to construct bombs. He had met with Ramzi Youssef in Pakistan, where they discussed bombing targets in the United States, and assembled a terrorist kit that included bomb-making manuals, operations guidance, videotapes advocating terrorist action against the United States, and false identification documents. Youssef was captured in Pakistan following the discovery by police in the Philippines in January 1995 of the Manila Air Plot, which envisioned placing bombs on board a dozen Trans-Pacific airliners and setting them off simultaneously. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Youssef's uncle, then located in Qatar, was a fellow plotter of Youssef's in the Manila Air Plot and had also wired him some money prior to the Trade Center bombing. The U.S. attorney obtained an indictment against KSM in January 1996, but an official in the government of Qatar probably warned him about it. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed evaded capture and stayed at large to play a central part in the 9/11 attacks. The law enforcement process is concerned with proving the guilt of persons apprehended and charged. Investigators and prosecutors could not present all the evidence of possible involvement of individuals, other than those charged, although they continued to pursue such investigations, planning or hoping for later prosecutions. The process was meant, by its nature, to mark for the public the events as finished, case solved, justice done. It was not designed to ask if the events might be harbingers of worse to come. Nor did it allow for aggregating and analyzing facts to see if they could provide clues to terrorist tactics more generally, methods of entry and finance, and mode of operation inside the United States. Fourth, although the bombing heightened awareness of a new terrorist danger, successful prosecutions contributed to widespread underestimation of the threat. The government's attorneys stressed the seriousness of the crimes and put forward evidence of Youssef's technical ingenuity. Yet the public image that persisted was not of clever Youssef, but of stupid Salome going back again and again to reclaim his $400 truck rental deposit. Section 3.2. Adaptation and Non-Adaptation in Law Enforcement Community. Legal processes were the primary method for responding to these early manifestations of a new type of terrorism. Our overview of U.S. capabilities for dealing with it thus begins with the nation's vast complex of law enforcement agencies. The Justice Department and the FBI. At the federal level, much law enforcement activity is concentrated in the Department of Justice. For countering terrorism, the dominant agency under Justice is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The FBI does not have a general grant of authority, but instead works under specific statutory authorizations. Most of its work is done in local offices called field offices. There are 56 of them, each covering a specified geographic area, and each quite separate from all others. Prior to 9/11, the special agent in charge was, in general, free to set his or her office's priorities and assign personnel accordingly. The office's priorities were driven by two primary concerns. First, performance in the Bureau is generally measured against statistics such as numbers of arrests, indictments, prosecutions, and convictions. Counterterrorism and counterintelligence work, often involving lengthy intelligence investigations that might never have positive or quantifiable results, was not career-enhancing. Most agents who reached management ranks had little counterterrorism experience. Second, priorities were driven at the local level by the field offices, whose concerns centered on traditional crimes such as white-collar offenses and those pertaining to drugs and gangs. Individual field offices made choices to serve local priorities, not national priorities. The Bureau also operates under an Office of Origin system. To avoid duplication and possible conflicts, the FBI designates a single office to be in charge of an entire investigation. Because the New York field office indicted Bin Laden prior to the East Africa bombings, it became the Office of Origin for all of Bin Laden's cases, including the East Africa bombings and later the attack on the USS Cole. Most of the FBI's institutional knowledge on bin Laden and al-Qaeda resided there. This office worked closely with the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York to identify, arrest, prosecute, and convict many of the perpetrators of the attacks and plots. Field offices other than the specified office of origin were often reluctant to spend much energy on matters over which they had no control and for which they received no credit. The FBI's domestic intelligence gathering dates from the 1930s. With World War II looming, President Franklin D. Roosevelt ordered FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to investigate foreign and foreign-inspired subversion, communist, Nazi, and Japanese. Hoover added investigation of possible espionage, sabotage, or subversion to the duties of field offices. After the war, foreign intelligence duties were assigned to the newly established Central Intelligence Agency. Hoover jealously guarded the FBI's domestic portfolio against all rivals. Hoover felt he was accountable only to the president, and the FBI's domestic intelligence activities kept growing. In the 1960s, the FBI was receiving significant assistance within the United States from the CIA and from Army intelligence. The legal basis for some of this assistance was dubious. Decades of encouragement to perform as a domestic intelligence agency abruptly ended in the 1970s. 2 years after Hoover's death in 1972, congressional and news media investigations of the Watergate scandals of the Nixon administration expanded into general investigations of foreign and domestic intelligence by the Church and Pike committees. They disclosed domestic intelligence efforts, which included a covert action program that operated from 1956 to 1971 against domestic organizations and eventually domestic dissidents. The FBI had spied on a wide range of political figures, especially individuals whom Hoover wanted to discredit, notably the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and had authorized unlawful wiretaps and surveillance. The shock registered in public opinion polls, where the percentage of Americans declaring a highly favorable view of the FBI dropped from 84% to 37%. The FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division was dissolved. In 1976, Attorney General Edward Leavy adopted domestic security guidelines to regulate intelligence collection in the United States and to deflect calls for even stronger regulation. In 1983, Attorney General William French Smith revised the Leavy guidelines to encourage closer investigation of potential terrorism. He also loosened the rules governing authorization for investigations and their duration. Still, his guidelines, like Leavy's, took account of the reality that suspicion of terrorism, like suspicion of subversion, could lead to making individuals targets for investigation more because of their beliefs than because of their acts. Smith's guidelines also took account of the reality that potential terrorists were often members of extremist religious organizations, and the investigations of terrorism could cross the line separating church and state. In 1986, Congress authorized the FBI to investigate terrorist attacks against Americans that occur outside the United States. 3 years later, it added authority for the FBI to make arrests abroad without consent from the host country. Meanwhile, a task force headed by Vice President George H.W. Bush had endorsed a concept already urged by Director of Central Intelligence William Casey, a counter-terrorist center, where the FBI, the CIA, and other organizations could work together on international terrorism. While it was distinctly a CIA entity, the FBI detailed officials to work at the center and obtained leads that helped in the capture of persons wanted for trial in the United States. The strengths that the FBI brought to the counterterrorism efforts were nowhere more brilliantly on display than in the case of Pan Am Flight 103, bound from London to New York, which blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland in December 1988, killing 270 people. Initial evidence pointed to the government of Syria and later Iran. The Counterterrorist Center reserved judgment on the perpetrators of the attack. Meanwhile, FBI technicians working with UK security services gathered and analyzed the widely scattered fragments of the airliner. In 1991, with the help of the Counter-Terrorist Center, they identified one small fragment as part of a timing device, to the technicians as distinctive as DNA. It was a Libyan device. Together with other evidence, the FBI put together a case pointing conclusively to the Libyan government. Eventually, Libya acknowledged its responsibility. Pan Am 103 became a cautionary tale against rushing to judgment in attributing responsibility for a terrorist act. It also showed again how, given a case to solve, the FBI remained capable of extraordinary investigative success. FBI Organization and Priorities. In 1993, President Clinton chose Louis Freeh as the director of the Bureau. Free, who would remain director until June 2001, believed that the FBI's work should be done primarily by the field offices. To emphasize this view, he cut headquarters staff and decentralized operations. The special agents in charge gained power, influence, and independence. Free recognized terrorism as a major threat. He increased the number of legal attaché offices abroad, focusing in particular on the Middle East. He also urged agents not to wait for terrorist attacks to occur before taking action. In his first budget request to Congress after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, he stated that merely solving this type of crime is not enough. It is equally important that the FBI thwart terrorism before such acts can be perpetrated. Within headquarters, he created a counterterrorism division that would complement the Counterterrorist Center at the CIA and arranged for exchanges of senior FBI and CIA counterterrorism officials. He pressed for more cooperation between legal attachés and CIA stations abroad. Free's efforts did not, however, translate into a significant shift of resources to counterterrorism. FBI, Justice, and Office of Management and Budget officials said that FBI leadership seemed unwilling to shift resources to terrorism from other areas such as violent crime and drug enforcement. Other FBI officials blamed Congress and the OMB for a lack of political will and failure to understand the FBI's counterterrorism resource needs. In addition, Free did not impose his views on the field offices. With a few notable exceptions, the field offices did not apply significant resources to terrorism and often reprogrammed funds for other priorities. In 1998, the FBI issued a 5-year strategic plan led by its deputy director, Robert Bear Bryant. For the first time, the FBI designated national and economic security, including counterterrorism, as its top priority. Dale Watson, who would later become the head of the new counterterrorism division, said that after the East Africa bombings, the light came on, that cultural change had to occur within the FBI. The plan mandated a stronger intelligence collection effort. It called for a nationwide automated system to facilitate information collection, analysis, and dissemination. It envisioned the creation of a professional intelligence cadre of experienced and trained agents and analysts. If successfully implemented, this would have been a major step toward addressing terrorism systematically rather than as individual unrelated cases, but the plan did not succeed. First, the plan did not obtain the necessary human resources. Despite designating national and economic security as its top priority in 1998, the FBI did not shift human resources accordingly. Although the FBI's counterterrorism budget tripled during the mid-1990s, FBI counterterrorism spending remained fairly constant between fiscal years 1998 and 2001. In 2000, there were still twice as many agents devoted to drug enforcement as to counterterrorism. Second, the new division intended to strengthen the FBI's strategic analysis capability faltered. It received insufficient resources and faced resistance from senior managers in the FBI's operational divisions. The new division was supposed to identify trends in terrorist activity, determine what the FBI did not know, and ultimately drive collection efforts. However, the FBI had little appreciation for the role of analysis. Analysts continued to be used primarily in a tactical fashion, providing support for existing cases. Compounding the problem was the FBI's tradition of hiring analysts from within instead of recruiting individuals with the relevant educational background and expertise. Moreover, analysts had difficulty getting access to the FBI and intelligence community information they were expected to analyze. The poor state of the FBI's information systems meant that such access depended in large part on an analyst's personal relationships with individuals in the operational units, or squads where the information resided. For all of these reasons, prior to 9/11, relatively few strategic analytic reports about counterterrorism had been completed. Indeed, the FBI had never completed an assessment of the overall terrorist threat to the U.S. homeland. Third, the FBI did not have an effective intelligence collection effort. Collection of intelligence from human sources was limited, and agents were inadequately trained. Only 3 days of a 16-week agents course were devoted to counterterrorism and counterintelligence, and most subsequent training was received on the job. The FBI did not have an adequate mechanism for validating source reporting, nor did it have a system for adequately tracking and sharing source reporting, either internally or externally. The FBI did not dedicate sufficient resources to the surveillance and translation needs of counterterrorism agents. It lacked sufficient translators proficient in Arabic and other key languages, resulting in a significant backlog of untranslated intercepts. Finally, the FBI's information systems were woefully inadequate. The FBI lacked the ability to know what it knew. there was no effective mechanism for capturing or sharing its institutional knowledge. FBI agents did create records of interviews and other investigative efforts, but there were no reports officers to condense the information into meaningful intelligence that could be retrieved and disseminated. In 1999, the FBI created separate counterterrorism and counterintelligence divisions. Dale Watson, the first head of the new counterterrorism division, recognized the urgent need to increase the FBI's counterterrorism capability. His plan, called MaxCap 05, was unveiled in 2000. It set the goal of bringing the Bureau to its maximum feasible capacity in counterterrorism by 2005. Field executives told Watson that they did not have the analysts, linguists, or technically trained experts to carry out the strategy. In a report provided to Director Robert Mueller in September 2001, 1 year after Watson presented his plan to field executives, almost every FBI field office was assessed to be operating below maximum capacity. The report stated that the goal to prevent terrorism requires a dramatic shift in emphasis from a reactive capability to a highly functioning intelligence capability, which provides not only leads and operational support, but clear strategic analysis and direction. Legal constraints on the FBI and the wall. The FBI had different tools for law enforcement and intelligence. For criminal matters, it could apply for and use traditional criminal warrants. For intelligence matters involving international terrorism, however, the rules were different. For many years, the Attorney General could authorize surveillance of foreign powers and agents of foreign powers without any court review. But in 1978, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This law regulated intelligence collection directed at foreign powers and agents of foreign powers in the United States. In addition to requiring court review of proposed surveillance and later physical searches, the 1978 Act was interpreted by the courts to require that a search be approved only if its primary purpose was to obtain foreign intelligence information. In other words, the authorities of the FISA law could not be used to circumvent traditional criminal warrant requirements. The Justice Department interpreted these rulings as saying that criminal prosecutors could be briefed on FISA information, but could not direct or control its collection. Throughout the 1980s and early 1990s, justice prosecutors had informal arrangements for obtaining information gathered in the FISA process, the understanding being that they would not improperly exploit that process for their criminal cases. Whether the FBI shared with prosecutors information pertinent to possible criminal investigations was left solely to the judgment of the FBI. But the prosecution of Aldrich Ames for espionage in 1994 revived concerns about the prosecutor's role in intelligence investigations. The Department of Justice's Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, or OIPR, is responsible for reviewing and presenting all FISA applications to the FISA court. It worried that because of the numerous prior consultations between FBI agents and prosecutors, the judge might rule that the FISA warrants had been misused. If that had happened, Ames might have escaped conviction. Richard Scruggs, the acting head of OIPR, complained to Attorney General Janet Reno about the lack of information-sharing controls. On his own, he began imposing information-sharing procedures for FISA material. The Office of Intelligence Policy and Review became the gatekeeper for the flow of FISA information to criminal prosecutors. In July 1995, Attorney General Reno issued formal procedures aimed at managing information sharing between Justice Department prosecutors and the FBI. They were developed in a working group led by the Justice Department's Executive Office of National Security, overseen by Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick. These procedures, while requiring the sharing of intelligence information with prosecutors, regulated the manner in which such information could be shared from the intelligence side of the House to the criminal side. These procedures were almost immediately misunderstood and misapplied. As a result, there was far less information sharing and coordination between the FBI and the criminal division in practice than was allowed under the department's procedures. Over time, the procedures came to be referred to as the wall. The term the wall is misleading, however, because several factors led to a series of barriers to information sharing that developed. The Office of Intelligence Policy and Review became the sole gatekeeper for passing information to the criminal division. Though Attorney General Reno's procedures did not include such a provision, the office assumed the role anyway, arguing that its position reflected the concerns of Judge Royce Lamberth, then Chief Judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. The office threatened that if it could not regulate the flow of information to criminal prosecutors, it would no longer present the FBI's warrant requests to the FISA court. The information flow withered. The 1995 procedures dealt only with sharing between agents and criminal prosecutors, not between two kinds of FBI agents, those working on intelligence matters and those working on criminal matters. But pressure from the Office of Intelligence Policy Review, FBI leadership, and the FISA court built barriers between agents, even agents serving on the same squads. FBI Deputy Director Bryant reinforced the office's caution by informing agents that too much information sharing could be a career stopper. Agents in the field began to believe, incorrectly, that no FISA information could be shared with agents working on criminal investigations. This perception evolved into the still more exaggerated belief that the FBI could not share any intelligence information with criminal investigators, even if